Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 10th, 1999, and in the Creekside room tonight there is a forum. And the forum is entitled Let Me In and Close the Door. It's a forum on Christian response to U.S. immigration issues. So why don't we go partake of this forum?
Hey, ministry, you can feel free to go ahead and start the tape. My name is Dan Spencer. I teach at Drake University and I'm one of the summer teaching staff coordinators.
I'm Jim Martin Schramm, and along with Dan, one of the summer teaching staff coordinators. The third member of the group is Karen, my wife, and she comes on Saturday. So.
And just a couple comments. So the forums are a long-standing tradition at Holden Village. They're designed as a couple opportunities each week when we gather together for lively conversation around topics of interest or topic of current import. The main point is to have everybody have a chance to have their piece heard. We aim for lively conversation, not for any conclusion per se, not trying to win points on either side of a debate, but really to sort of air different ideas and thoughts about particular issues here. So Jim and I will moderate, but we welcome everybody's participation about what your own thoughts and or questions or perspectives are on the issue that we're looking at tonight. The topic title is, well, I got a question mark. Let me in, then close the door, question mark. And it comes a little bit from, I thought of it because of a comment my mother made. My mother grew up in Minnesota, hated Midwestern winters. The first chance she got in the late 40s, she moved to California. But she always told me she wanted to move to California and have her be allowed in, and then she wanted to close the door so no one else would be allowed into paradise. And of course, many, many tens of millions of more people have come into California since my mother moved there 50 years ago, much to her dismay. But one of the more recent things has been the influx of immigrants, not only in California, but in many parts of our country, and the debates that is bringing with it. So particularly since Bob has been sharing with us this week some of the different push factors, pull factors about immigration, and some of the debates that come about when people enter legally, according to the United States laws, and also illegally, and without following those laws, what are the kinds of tensions, dynamics that result? So, Jim, you're going to get us started with a little exercise here.
Yeah, we just thought it might be interesting to put this conversation into some perspective. And so I'm going to ask you to stand, and you'll stand at the appropriate time. You'll have to decide when that time is. If anyone has just recently come to the United States as an immigrant, please stand up. Please stand up if your parents immigrated to the United States.
If one of your parents
immigrated. Or at least one of your parents immigrated. Stand up if one of your grandparents immigrated to the United States.
Keep standing, please.
Yes. How about your great-grandparents? Great-great-grandparents. Great-great-great-great-grandparents.
Thank you.
By now, I'm probably standing, too. I don't know your name.
Darlene.
Darlene. If I kept going, Darlene, would you be standing?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, let's all stand. We're all the progeny, in one form or another, of immigrants to the United States. So any kind of a conversation we have about immigration today, I think we need to understand within this context that all of us are here because people were able to immigrate to this country. So, please.
Oh, you're going to ask a question, aren't you?
Well, sure. That's right. Please stand again.
Stand up for just a moment.
Yeah.
This sounds like
I forget about that. Now, I'm going to invite you to sit. If your ancestors came to the United States legally. Now, what is different about what just happened?
We all sat together.
What?
We all sat down together.
We all sat down together. But what's important about what just happened? That the vast majority of immigration that took place to the United States took place under the conditions of legality. Most of, apparently everybody in this room, their ancestors immigrated to the United States legally and with the invitation of the United States to come.
Of course, it was legally according to the rules of the first immigrants who weren't exactly invited by the original inhabitants.
Right.
So in that sense, all of us are expropriators of a land that didn't invite us in, but once enough of us got here, we could change the rules, and then most of the rest of us arrived according to those rules.
And of course, if we had African-American brothers and sisters here, many of them came here, obviously, in a forced fashion.
But legally.
As slaves, but legally, that's right. That, of course, is what is so different about much of the debate today. There's still a lot of debate about the legal cap for immigration to the United States, but so much of the debate in the United States revolves around the issue of illegal immigration. And just for the sake of focusing our reflection tonight, we're really going to try to focus more on the issue of illegal immigration. We've jotted up here on the board some facts or some information that is, I think, to some extent helpful as we think about this. There are, at any given point in a year, between 60 and 100 million refugees or displaced persons in the world. A displaced person is someone who has been forced out of their home but remains within their country. A refugee is someone who's been forced from their home and out of their country. So at any given time, these are UN statistics, between 60 and 100 million people are on the move. Now, we have about 6 billion people in the world right now. October 12th is the day the UN will officially celebrate the birth of the 6 billionth child. But the statistics indicate, at least, or the trends show, that our population as a globe will continue to grow, and that 95% of that growth will be in nations that right now are fairly poor, and some of those folks are certainly migrating to places that are wealthier or that may be more stable politically, socially or religiously. So there are various reasons why people leave their homes. I'm sure most of you have never thought of leaving your home unless it was for a very good reason. These are the things that push people out, make them leave: war, poverty, unemployment, environmental problems, famine, and hunger. And then, of course, it's all the positive sides of that that draw them to other countries. And, of course, with the United States as being, in the most of the world's eyes, the wealthiest nation in the world, you can understand why many of those people want to come here, the land of opportunity, right? According to the Population Reference Bureau, the United States accepts about one half of the world's legal immigrants. We take a half of all of the people that immigrate, and everybody else goes to the other countries of the world. So for those that may want to say the U.S. isn't doing enough, there are many who might say, well, we're doing quite a bit. There are 1.5 to 2.5 million people that enter the U.S. illegally each year, but only, just a minute, let me back off from that. The U.S. Congress determines each year how many people can immigrate to the United States legally. In addition to that, there are a few more people that are allowed in as official refugees or as asylees. And those folks don't always apply for citizenship status. But in 1998, the cap was 880,000 people who were allowed to immigrate to the United States. Who is allowed to come is a complicated thing, and it's not equal, it's not fair, it's not based on demographics, so you'd think China would have the most opportunity, most people, but that isn't the way it works. If you're from Eastern Europe, and if you're from Latin America, some countries in Latin America, you have a better chance than if you're from China or from the Philippines or places like that. But we're not going to focus so much on the legal issue as much as on the illegal issue. There are, according to the, there was a bipartisan commission on immigration in the U.S. Congress about 2 years ago. And they agreed as a bipartisan commission that the data indicates that there are 1.5 to 2 million people that enter the United States illegally each year. About half of those people cross the border illegally. The other half of those people come across the border legally. They have tourist visas or they have student visas, and when those visas expire, they don't leave, they stay. So we shouldn't think of this 1.5 to 2.5 million people as, forgive the term, wetbacks. Not all of those folks are people surreptitiously entering the United States across the Mexican border. Some of those folks are students that overstayed their visas, or tourists that didn't get back on the plane in Orlando and decided to stay. But the interesting thing is that this bipartisan commission reached the conclusion that while 1.5 to 2.5 million people enter the U.S., the vast majority of them go home each year as well. So that each year there's only a net return of about, or a net gain of about 300,000 permanent settlers that are here illegally. Now, obviously, the vast majority of these folks that are crossing the border illegally are doing so to work in our agricultural fields and in our meatpacking industry and some other places like that. So about 900,000 people coming in legally, and about another 300,000 after everybody's come and gone as a net gain illegally. But that doesn't change the fact that when they're in the United States, that's still a lot of new people that are in your community or in your region for a while.
So one of the things that's, I think, tough on an issue like this is to balance the numbers and the statistics, which are really important because they give us some sense of the magnitude, but also to recognize that each one of these is an individual human being. And I remember, I look at these numbers sometimes and I think about what Mark Twain, I think, was it who said that there are lies, there are damn lies, and then there are statistics. Sometimes statistics shed a lot of light, but sometimes statistics also can cause us to miss other factors. And so what we want to focus on a lot tonight is our experiences ourselves in our own home regions and congregations about these, the people involved in these and the issues that are being raised. One of the ways we thought about doing that was we asked Bob if Bob would give us one or two stories of people that he knows so we can put some human faces on these statistics, and then we'll talk about the ways that we're affecting in our own regions, our congregations, our own towns and states. But Bob, do you have a story or two there?
Every quarter we print a newspaper, bilingual newspaper, and we always have a story of how did you get here? And these are mostly Mexicans and Central American people that have come illegally.
Bob, let's just introduce you for folks that may be new in the village. Bob Ekblad, you tell them who you are.
Yeah, I'm Bob Ekblad. I'm a Presbyterian pastor working in a ministry called Tierra Nueva, New Earth. And we are a ministry to migrant farm workers in western Washington. And I'm also the chaplain of a county jail. So anyway, here's a few stories. Five of us came with the pollero, the smuggler. He charged me $600 to take me to Phoenix, but he gave me a discount for getting the other three, charging me $470. I waited a week at the border, where we paid a hotel for 2 days. 2 days they paid the coyote and the smuggler, and 2 days we stayed in the coyote's house. One day before crossing, the coyote went to a wedding, and when he saw the car of the newlyweds all decorated, he got an idea. On his van, he wrote, "Either I marry or I'll run and regret it." He put on bows and decorated it like a newlywed's car, buying suits for us. Then he brought us in our suits to the hill of Nogales. That's right on the border of the U.S. We ran into some gang members that are known to rob those who cross over in a little store, and we tricked them too. The coyote told us to collect soil and pretend like we were examining it. We carried some folders that we opened and wrote down something. When we came up to the gang members, all of them hid in the little store, thinking we were police agents, except one guy from whom we asked the name of the street. After he gave us the information, we continued and jumped over the border fence through climbing out the tube. The gang members saw all this. When we crossed the border, the coyote told us to continue like it was nothing, talking and commenting on the work that we were doing. It was then that we ran into a Border Patrol blazer. The official greeted us and passed us, but he stopped up ahead. He waited for us, but he greeted us again, and we continued like it was nothing. He was watching out for us without saying anything to us. Further ahead, we took a taxi that brought us to the hotel where we spent the night. We arrived at the hotel at 7 p.m. The next day at about 1 p.m., we went in a van decorated for newlyweds, taking us to Phoenix. When we were almost at Tucson, we knew that there were checkpoints. We returned to Nogales to sneak around this checkpoint and took another road, where we ran into three immigration trucks. Later, we crossed over a river, but the van stalled because the spark plug wires got wet when we crossed the river. We got out to dry the wires when an immigration truck passing by without saying anything to us. This is because they had suits and ties on, right? From there, the van started, and the coyote told us that if there weren't any more checkpoints ahead, we would make it. From there, we went without stopping to Phoenix. Along the road, the people applauded us and congratulated us because they thought the bridegroom was really there. From there, we didn't have a single delay, nothing at all to Phoenix. That's a more creative effort, I think. Wait, let me tell you. At first, there was a coyote. You know what a coyote is, a smuggler, okay? Who got it out of us. Those of us coming were two women and two men. They charged us $1,100. But we didn't like it because they wanted to bring us across, the women first, and they just kept us standing for 24 hours on the hill. Besides, he asked for money from a family member and robbed us of $250. Afterwards, we met another coyote who assured me that he'd crossed me over at the border, and he was going to charge me the same as the other coyote. I was waiting 3 days when he arrived. He took me to buy clothes because I had to disguise myself as a chola, which is a gang member from the USA. He bought me a very short blouse and a pair of very skimpy shorts. He did up my hair and bought me a piece of cake so that they would think that I had just gone to Tijuana from San Diego to shop. When we were at the border, he gave me a mica, a U.S. resident alien card, with someone else's name. He warned me to not look around and that if I crossed over, to continue on as if nothing happened, to not look for them. I went sweating down to the crotch. When I got to the official, he asked me what I was carrying there. I answered a piece of cake. Then he asked who had given me the residency card and how I obtained legal residency. When he finished, instead of leaving, I looked around everywhere for the coyotes. When they saw me, they gave me a good scolding. After that, they took me to eat. That's when some officials of immigration arrived and they said, "What do you think, that you're going in?" They had doubts and continued to ask me questions like which was my printing finger. In Mexico, fingerprinting is done with the thumb. In the U.S., the index finger is used. If she'd shown her thumb, they'd suspect she was crossing illegally. They let us go in peace. But this wasn't everything. We had to pass through the checkpoint at San Clemente, where they asked me more questions and asked me for a piece of cake. Once we passed there, the coyote told me that we'd made it, but he didn't take into account the other checkpoint before entering L.A., where they once again asked more questions. In spite of everything, I succeeded in crossing, and now I'm here with my husband, who came first and then brought me up. We were recently married. Now we've been married and in this country for a year. He's 22 and I'm 21. All we want to do is pull together a little money and return to our land. Although it is difficult with the migra, which is the Spanish name for the INS, one lives with the fear that any day they'll pick us up. Though if this happened, our return trip would be free. Now these are two pretty tame stories. I mean, I know I've heard stories of people going in trunks of cars, you know, in blazing heat, you know, crammed in trunks or crammed underneath the seats of vans and cars and of others that have gone across into the desert and, you know, wandered in the desert for days. But anyway, two out of many stories.
One of the things I think is helpful, Bob, is that it becomes clear that there are literally thousands and thousands of people who risk a lot, family, friends, and health and everything, in order to try and get here to the States. And one of the things that I would like to do is, I know several people come from communities that are dealing with this issue, and I thought we'd start by just hearing, what is it that you hear in your own region? Maybe tell us where you are. How does the issue of immigration, especially illegal immigration, come up? What kind of concerns or what kind of debates does it raise So what are we hearing in our home places about the issue of illegal immigration?
I would say my hometown is Portland, Oregon, and I'm actually kind of dismayed at how little we hear about the Hispanic population. It's in actually quite large numbers around the region, not in the inner city so much, but it's amazing to me how invisible the Hispanic people are. And dismay is something that we completely ignore and don't talk about. Or if we do talk about it, it's in terms of this outside sort of problem that we don't want to really deal with.
Are they involved primarily in agricultural work?
Yeah.
Feeding crops?
Yeah.
My family is from Southern California, and the times that I go back just to visit, what I hear most in terms of people's relation to the immigrant population, both from Mexico and from Vietnam and Korea, is just that they completely ruined that they completely ruined California. That's the explanation for people's driving more poorly, for the gang violence, and just about everything. So those are the main conversations I hear in Southern California.
We have in Yakima 47% Mexican now in the city of Yakima. And they had, they work in the fruit, they work in the warehouses. And we had one warehouse that the authorities came in and made the illegals leave, and most of them, it was most of the employees, but they were back soon with new cards.
I remember a very striking image for me. I live in Iowa, and there a lot of it's meatpacking plants, and from time to time the INS comes in and does raids, and rounds up those who don't have documentation, ships them off. But it was very striking for me. 2 years ago, several of us took a group of Drake students to the border between El Paso, Texas, and Juarez, and there there actually were buses just waiting on the border there with the destinations like Greeley, Colorado, and Storm Lake, Iowa, places where all the different meatpacking plants were, where people were simply smuggling people right across the border, and then they get them on the buses and ship them directly off these places. So there's clearly a well-coordinated effort going on, even though it was totally illegal. Clearly, somebody was complicit in bringing in a lot of these workers from the border area to these areas. But the workers we talked to said it was basically a revolving door. They would go there, and like Bob's story said, you know, they would work as long as they could until they got the, quote, free ride back to Mexico. And then they would wait for a certain number of weeks, and then they would cross the border and find some way to get back in, get hooked up, and come into this area. Joel?
Are you saying the INS sort of closes its eyes to it when you said it?
Well, that was, you know, there's all sorts of, in Iowa anyway, speculation about this, and there's a lot of pressure to increase the INS presence, open up an office in Des Moines, because most of the office has been in Omaha, Nebraska. And so there's a lot of pressure on the plants to only hire people who have certified Social Security, but still there seems to be this real pipeline coming in.
Well, we actually need the illegal aliens, and we're both from Yakima, Washington, because our fruit has to be harvested, and we don't have enough people that are willing of the Caucasian race to do that.
To work in the counties, we have Del Monte County, which is most of the workers are Mexican. So.
And is that because of the kind of work or the pay or what? Why can't they get enough employment?
It's, the pay is lower than what the whites want. And they're not willing to do that hard work.
Does the cannery pay minimum wage?
No.
I think they pay a little more.
Yes.
I think they can combine it with a, if it's seasonal work.
Then they don't have to adhere to those
minimum wage
labor laws.
But the ones that stay, they work hard to move from down the middle of our town, one side is streets and one side is avenues. And they're very proud to be able to say that they live on an avenue and not on a street.
I think that, well, we live on a meat patent in town of Austin, Minnesota. And I sense that, well, I've been active with Habitat, and I was thinking, you know, naively that they would apply for homes. And they're, you know, just looking around, observing, I think that they are going to the rougher type of houses, you know, that are cheaper, you know. And I don't know if that means that they are illegal or that they just don't know how to go about applying.
Were you in Austin during the real bitter labor strikes there in Hormel? Because part of what my understanding was happened throughout at least the Midwest in the meatpacking industry is that many of the plants which were unionized and paid pretty high paying jobs progressively have the unions have been broken and the jobs now pay half to a third of what they used to. And so you've seen a real transformation of what were fairly stable towns with stable labor forces of people who had lived in those towns for generations, and you often just you had two or three generations of a family working in the plant. Now they really have a mobile workforce that's brought in.
We've got a two-tier kind of system here because Hormel is the meat processing. They don't slaughter, but then they've got another company called Quality Pork. Mm-hmm. That does the dirty work, you know, and
these low wages.
And they pay low
wages. I think we've not heard about illegal people being there, but I just would not be surprised. Mm-hmm. And we know we have a number of people from outside. We have a lot of Asian people too. Because our church is just starting to get involved, and there was a meeting the day before we left home, and I just wasn't able to go, about how we can work with these people to help get them integrated into the community, help them with shopping and that sort of thing.
I'm from Walla Walla, a fruit veggie place. I think our Hispanic population runs around 18%. And I'm just sitting here thinking, I know very little. I know it from a social service worker and the Hispanic social service people that I worked with in the Head Start and so forth. I'm not 100% sure. I've had the sense, and Bob may know because we're in the same state, these are migrants. But a lot of them, I think, are Texans.
And they follow the harvest. Right?
They follow the harvest. They're migrants. I don't know if they're here legally, illegally, but they're Texans and travel that way. And quite a few, they refer to themselves as settlers. And of course, there's there's differences between the settlers and the migrants, Hispanic population in our area.
Some of them in Yakima work as gardeners, and they stay in Yakima, and they'll send money to Mexico, but they are excellent gardeners and landscapers.
You raise a really important point there, too, about part of the phenomenon. It varies by different groups, but there are actually enormous amounts of money now that are being sent back to the countries of origin. In El Salvador, it's over $1 billion a year that Salvadorans working in the United States are sending back to El Salvador. It's now become the number one industry in the entire nation. There's more money raised by Salvador is living in the States and sending money back than there is through coffee and any other industry there. And so part of the concern on the countries that are from that end is they're very concerned that if the borders get shut and these people get sent back, their internal economies collapse. They become so dependent on the enormous amounts of money that that migrant workers and others are earning here and sending back.
Yeah. That's true for Mexico, too.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of Mexican people in our region, we have many Mixteco Indians who speak Mixteco or Triqui with Oaxaca. And many of the men are legal, you know, because they've been coming here for many years and they benefited from the amnesty in 1986. But then they've since gone back and gotten their wives and a lot of their kids and other family members, and you know, because they don't want to be up here alone. And so anyway, there's lots and lots of every family is distinct, obviously, but the immigration status of people is very complex. I know families where the husband is legal and the wife and maybe two of the oldest kids are illegal. And then all the younger kids are all U.S. citizens because they were born here. And I know others where the man is illegal because he lost his residency because of some crime he committed, and the wife is legal. And then the kids are all U.S. citizens. And I mean, there's incredible combinations out there, every combination possible. So, you know, you're not sure whether these people are illegal. If you went to 10 households, you'd probably find that sort of complexity.
Other stories from your regions or from your towns? For those of you that have shared stories about immigrants or illegal immigrants in the community, are your congregations involved with immigrants, either legal or illegal, either now or in the past, and what sorts of ministries are those?
Our congregation is getting ready for a third refugee family, and we're in Louisville, Kentucky, and the whole community really prides itself on successfully settling both Catholic Charities and Kentucky Refugee Ministry, which is the Protestant end. Basically, don't have problem getting congregations, and they get a lot of publicity and a lot of, and I know our congregation just delights in doing it, and employment is wonderful. So, and there's all kinds of jobs that need somebody to do, and the immigrants tend to take those tougher jobs, and so they contribute that way. Mm-hmm. And there may be illegal folks, but we don't seem to know about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't make the papers. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no tension about that. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that story is happening. Right now we're getting ready for coastal bars. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that story is like that across the country or not. Mm-hmm. But we don't have the, you know, we're not on the border, and we don't have the that kind of action. But the community feels good about, mm-hmm. of course, the economy's good too. And
mm-hmm. Yes.
Everywhere we go, there's workers wanted. I mean, signs.
Right. We have a similar situation in Des Moines, Iowa. I think that Des Moines' official unemployment is less than 2%. It's a very
yes, we're that's high, where we are.
Yeah, and so Des Moines has settled a large community of Bosnians, a large community of Somalians and Ethiopians, and you see distinctive communities and the efforts to integrate them in. But at the same time, we have a large Hispanic, Mexican American, Central American community that's much less visual to the official channels, and part of what becomes clear when you start working is that it ends up being a very vulnerable population because of the fears. Like Bob was saying, it often has very mixed interrelationships too. When we did this trip to the border, we spent a lot of time interviewing Mexican families on the other side, and part of their big fear and part of the big dilemma was getting families caught on both sides of the border. For example, the wife might be picked up in the meatpacking plant and sent home, and the husband is left in Worthington, Minnesota, or someplace with the kids. And then once you start getting these families broken up like that, it was very, very concern. And so as a result, they faced a lot of problems. If the family member had health issues or education issues, they oftentimes wouldn't try to take advantage, even if they were entitled to something, because the level of vulnerability, the level of exposure. So you create these groupings and communities of very vulnerable people because of the fear of getting deported or getting picked up.
We have raids in our county on a regular basis, and it's slowing down now, but because there's a new tactic that the INS has, which is going in and doing audits and checking, cross-checking, social security numbers and residency cards. And then that's what they did in Yakima recently. They gave these big warehouses lists of like 700 names of workers that they needed to fire. Well, those workers are just now going and they just get a new identity. They pay for counterfeit documents that say they're somebody else, and then go right back to the same place and they're being hired. Because even though the warehouses, they may recognize the faces, they have a different identity card. And that's happening. I mean, that's the Border Patrol is really against this new policy because it just leads to more, it just enriches the fraudulent document makers, manufacturers, which abound, But anyway, the raids are dividing families, a lot. I mean, I don't know, I've shared the story in another session, but I've had numerous cases where, the INS has swooped down on a potato plant, where they're sorting potatoes after the harvest, and taken women and men and deported them, and then the schools will call us and say, hey, we got these kids. No one can, they don't have anywhere to go, we don't know what to do with them. There's these four kids. Do you have any place we can, where these people can stay? And that's commoner. The other day in the jail, there was a 14-year-old kid who got caught driving, I think, and he had a fake piece of ID that said he was 18. And so, but he's just a kid. He's in my jail Bible study, and I called the Border Patrol, and I said, this guy's 14, and they said, well, even if he's 14, we're going to deport him. So they're deporting children without their parents, without anybody.
I live in Minneapolis and I work at an ESL school for immigrants and refugees, and that was started by a church in 1981 for refugees that were in the neighborhood, and they quickly realized they needed to not only serve refugees but also immigrants, illegal or legal. And one of the things that we do that I think that the people that come to us really appreciate is we don't want to know their status. We don't care if they're illegal, we don't care if they're legal, if they're refugees or whatever. And so they look to us as a very safe place because we're private and because we don't get any money from the government, we aren't required to ask them those questions. So it puts a strain on our funding sometimes because we won't take any state funds, but then it also provides a safe space for those people that may or may not be illegal. And I do notice the difference between people that are refugees that have that safety of, it's okay for them to be in this country, the United States government said it's okay for them to be here, compared to those that are not and don't have that safety net. I have a women's book group, and it was going really well, and a couple years ago, somebody from a neighborhood church wanted to interview and kind of sit in on the book group and see what it was like, because we have people from Somalia and Nigeria and Mexico and all over, and wanted to just ask, go around the room and have people say their name and where they're from. And a woman from Nigeria wouldn't give her name or wouldn't say where she was from. And it was simply because she was so scared that this woman was actually from the INS, undercover as this church reporter. And just to live in that fear every single day is just amazing to me.
Anna, you raised an interesting point in terms of this originally had a church involvement. And one of the things we wanted to start thinking about a little bit is what should Christians' response be to this phenomenon? On the one hand, we've got laws that are set up to regulate these kinds of things. On the other hand, there's tremendous economic pressure and other pressures that are driving people to enter the country by any means possible there. And how do we as Christians respond to that? What are the biblical resources? What are the theological resources? You're saying that your ministry has explicitly said you don't want to know the status. What kinds of things are people talking about, or how do people think through that? You did this as part of Lutheran Volunteer Corps as well, right? So a faith-based group. But for you or other folks, how do we think through this in terms of giving or thinking what it means to have a Christian voice or Christian perspective in this?
One of the first things we have to do is you say that people are people. I live in South Florida, where a huge distinction is made between white Cubans and black Haitians. And the excuse for why the Cubans should be accepted is that they're fleeing Castro. And the excuse for why the Haitians shouldn't be accepted is that they're economic refugees, and we just, there are too many problems. We can't fix all the problems in Haiti. But the obvious thing is it's politics. In one case, it's right-wing anti-communist dogma that says they should come in, and in the other case, it's racism that wants to keep people out. So the church has to look at the humanity of the people and say whatever rules we set up, they should be based on the fact that they're should have some basis that applies to all people, regardless of their nationality and race and politics. I mean, I think the church ought to make that, expose that double standard that's very, very rampant there. Mm-hmm. Or even in the Balkans, you know, how come so much excitement about a bunch of white people who kill each other and not the same thing in Rwanda a few years ago where, you know, it was worse, really.
What are the sorts of resources Christians can or should draw upon to address these sorts of issues?
The inescapable teachings of both Old Testament and New Testament about concern for the stranger.
Okay, hospitality to the stranger.
Yeah, that toward the end of Matthew 25, one of the last things Jesus said before the Passion, talked about those people who are very vulnerable, those without homes, without food, without shelter in prison. And like it or not, no matter what our politics might be or how we might worry about preserving our way of life, the mandate is there to take care of people who are struggling to take care of themselves.
It's pretty interesting when you grab Joe. I mean, it just permeates both testaments that, I mean, the whole story of Abraham starts with a wandering Aramean was my father. You know, Charlie had us look at the story of Joseph, and they just imbue both testaments. And Jesus responds to his disciples and says, "I have no place to lay, the Son of Man has no place to lay his own head." These stories come up time and again. It seems to be a faith perspective that's just deeply interwoven with these stories of exile and sojourn and homelessness and how is God present in the midst of those times?
Isn't it Matthew's gospel where Jesus is born and then has to flee to Egypt as a refugee?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What's really striking to me too is how many times in the biblical perspective it's the outsider who shows the kindness or the hospitality as well, the one who's outside the community doesn't have any kind of moral or legal responsibility in that sense, but time and again that comes out.
If you look at Genesis chapter 18, you know, the welcoming of the strangers, the three angels who are identified as God by Abraham, but they're humans, you know, they come and Abraham shows hospitality, and it's just like the model of hospitality to the foreigner, right? That text is tied directly together with the Sodom and Gomorrah story, which is the opposite, you know, which is the three strangers are treated, you know, they're brutalized and abused by the Sodomites, right? And so, rarely do we read those stories back to back, but really those two stories are meant to be two contrasts of how to treat the stranger. You know, we look at Sodom as mainly a question of homosexuality, but if you look at the tradition of the sin of Sodom, it's mainly a rejection of the foreigner and oppression of the poor. And there's four or five texts that talk about that.
And it's really explicit at one place, but and welcome the sojourner in your midst because you were sojourner.
But let me ask you this. Are we called to be hospitable to no end? Is it unreasonable for some people to say, you know, we've been hospitable, I want to continue to be hospitable, but we can't be hospitable to everyone?
There is some
injustice in the folks that are trying to enter the country legally and are on lists, and the folks that are more enterprising and aren't on lists but come in anyway, you know. And so there is a sense there of not playing fair, and therefore there should be some concern to do the law. As we have the laws or change the laws, but out of the fairness, because there seems to be a quota of some kind, you know. And so there are many folks that are trying to come into the country and have to wait and stand in line, and that there ought to be some kind of fairness.
Thanks, Denise, or this gentleman?
Oh, I made a sound.
Okay.
I was just wondering whether we can view a solution just looking at our churches, or whether the churches, the people in the churches, should be putting pressure on our government to make it more hospitable on a legal sense. Because, you know, within our churches, there's so many people that would be against allowing illegals to be more, for our government to be more lenient towards illegals. And I can see where that would just really be a hassle within the churches, like so many other things.
Sure. Several hands. David, and did you have a comment? No, and Jennifer, and then Bob, maybe?
As I look at the pull factors and the push factors, and as I think about what it means to be hospitable, I keep thinking that if I had to leave my home and go somewhere else, a sort of second best solution for me would be there being hospitable, whereas the first best solution would be that the push factors actually disappear.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so it seems to me that churches might have to walk a fine line in terms of being hospitable, but that shouldn't be the only thing that the churches do, because it seems that the push, that if you don't get rid of the push factors, if you're accepting, that just seems to be dealing with the crisis moment, and it's not dealing with the real root causes.
And push factors, if you, they don't all originate because of these undeveloped countries' own policies. And I look up their war and repression. We have a policy of low-grade military conflicts that involves poverty and landlessness. We support plantation economies in those countries. We profit from sweatshops that deliver products to us. Environmental degradation. We dump our garbage and waste in other countries. We're responsible for a lot of those push factors.
Bob?
I just wanted to comment to what you were saying about people waiting in line. You know, most of the people that are waiting in line to come in are waiting in line to come in legally.
Yeah.
People that come in illegally, they don't have the benefits of legal status, right? So they're constantly insecure. Recently, we've had an experience of where we tried to bring three Hondurans that were part of our ministry for the last 18 years, and we worked in Honduras beginning in 81. And we had three Honduran lay pastors that we were trying to bring in, and we sent a letter with the support of the Presbytery of North Puget Sound and the Lutheran Church and a number of pastors. And, you know, we sent photocopies of the round-trip tickets and everything, and the people were denied tourist visas. And so I began, and they were told because they didn't have a bank account and they didn't have a job. Well, they didn't have a job because they were subsistence farmers. They were peasants, right? And they didn't have a bank account because, for the same reason, and they'll never have a bank account. And so whereas somebody who's making money selling drugs, I mean, you know, there's plenty of those kind of people that get into the States just at the drop of a hat, I mean, or people that are exploiting all their workers and, you know, because they have their bank account, right? The only way we could finally get these three people to get visas was to go to one of our senators
And because we had, you know, the pull and the influence, we got a senator to write a letter and then allow these three Honduran lay workers to get their visas. So there's a tremendous injustice in terms of the whole process of getting, you know, entrance, coming into this country. In the same way for becoming a resident, like a landed immigrant here, you have way more advantages if you're from an upper-class family than if you're from poor, moving poor.
Well, but it seems to me, Bob, what you're saying, what Jennifer is saying, too, is that in some ways the whole phenomenon of illegal immigration is really a symptom of much deeper lying issues, and whether it's the injustices between who has access to getting quotas or whether it's the internal problems that are going on that are in large part caused by external factors such as the global economy, such as the, Joel, so you pointed out several things. And so, but I always think it's very, you know, how do we deal both with the immediate human needs of people who present themselves, but also the deeper underlying structures on them? Sometimes an example I use with my class sometimes, because people sometimes use this kind of a glib response that, so I think it's a, I forget, it's a Chinese parable or some parable, that if I give someone a fish, I feed them for a day. If I teach them to fish, I feed them for a lifetime. But in many of these situations, it's much more complex than that. And so it's...
It seems there's fish in that.
Well, it's, so if I give them access to the lake, you know, and the place to fish in the first place, because the vast majority, so many of these people are simply structured out of that by their economy and so forth. Or if I quit polluting the lake so that the fish there die in the first place. And so, you know, how to start looking at... I think you're right exactly, Jennifer, in terms of what really needs to be addressed is these... a lot of the push factors in those local places, but to what extent are those internally generated versus out of people's control in that area? And that's where I think we as Christians, you know, as David was saying, have a lot to say about the kinds of policies that our government helps foster, economic and what other places, that continue to generate these instabilities in these places that then get aggravated by things like Hurricane Mitch. You know, it's not coincidental when a hurricane hits Miami of similar magnitude, you may have 20 or 30 people die. It hits Honduras and Nicaragua, and you have 15 to 20,000 die and a million people homeless. So natural disasters are also social disasters when all these other factors come in, but they all end up generating people with tremendous human need. And then how do we begin to look at those?
One thing that's been taking place is within the nation, our official development assistance, our foreign aid to poor nations has been declining and has been steadily declining for, well, since the mid-80s at least. And so if, I mean, I'm not sure that would necessarily solve the problem to throw USAID money at Honduras or at, name a poor country, but if it were targeted and used correctly or better, it might ameliorate some of the problems that economic globalization and unfair trading relationships perpetuate. But the reality is, as a country, and not only as a country, but as a part of most industrialized nations, official development assistance is declining and has been declining for some time. It's only the Scandinavian countries that put us to shame. And that's only on a per capita basis, of course. How many of you are members of the ELCA? Okay. How many of you are aware that the ELCA has a recent, quote, message on immigration? Okay. A couple. Are you ordained?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And Joel was ordained. His hand went up, too. Everybody that's ordained probably got this sent, mailed to them. This is in the Resource Center across the hall. I just mentioned it. We're not going to pursue it much. But the division, the board of the Division for Church and Society approved this message on immigration. It provides a lot of information about legal and illegal immigration. And I just thought, if it's all right, I just read some of the sentences that are more... normative, I guess, towards the end, you know, the we ought to, we support, we think kinds of sentences. We encourage our members, in light of our history and our ministry with newcomers, to join with other citizens in our democratic society to support just laws that serve the common good. We support a generous policy of welcome for refugees and immigrants, and we will advocate and to advocate for just immigration policies, including fairness and visa regulations. Support the concept of one variable cap for immigrants that in principle gives residents of all nations equal opportunity to immigrate. Family reunification should be the primary objective of immigration laws. We welcome the desire of immigrants to become citizens. More should be done to restore benefits for legal immigrants that were removed recently by Congress. We urge leaders and citizens to seek feasible responses to to come up with flexible and humane ways to deal with undocumented persons who have been in this country for a period of time so that they can become legal. We believe that our country has a responsibility to increase the number of refugees it admits. We urge our government to do more to provide African refugees a fair opportunity to be resettled in our country. We advocate for reliable, consistent, and sensitive implementation of a law governing asylum seekers. It's a slim distinction between a refugee and asylee. A refugee is someone who requests permission to come to the United States for religious or political persecution, but they request the permission to come beforehand. An asylee is someone who is facing persecution, doesn't have time to ask permission, gets on a boat or on a bus or on a plane and arrives and then asks for asylum in the United States. So the ULC is asking for a reliable, consistent and sensitive implementation. And then just one last thing on the border with Mexico. We have serious doubts about the rightness and effectiveness of current policy to erect imposing physical barriers between the United States and Mexico. That is a large wall, basically, between us and Mexico. So just to give those of you that haven't had a chance to see here or read this a taste, at least, of what the ELCA is talking about. The document is in the Resource Center, and a booklet, or a, what do you call that, a little box that contains the ELCA stuff. So, yeah, I think no more than five more minutes. Closing comments, reactions, concerns.
I think you tried to touch on the issue. Well, what are the limits? Because you just opened the borders, let everybody in, mm-hmm. make this another poor country, and that attitude is very, very strong among the population, and it has a rational basis. I think, the best thing the church can do is to foster direct contact, direct relationship with the people. Not just to say, you know, we help fund this, but to actually provide the face-to-face encounter that provides us with the better understanding of the push factors. What's the reality in those other countries, and what's behind those reality that ties to us? It's significant, I think, that in terms of the money that goes into solving world poverty, I don't know what the ratio is compared to government money, but I think the smartest money is usually from major foundations, and they, in recent years, have shifted from direct aid to a recognition that we have to put more money into programs that foster education about world reality for North Americans. I mean, they recognize that part of solving the problems in other parts of the world has to do with educating us in this part of the world about what the real basis of those problems are. And that's something that we ought to be able to do as a church. I mean, I think a lot of the reason scriptures and our traditions are so strong on hospitality to the stranger is not just that the stranger needs it, but that it's good for us to have that encounter. It changes us, it humanizes us, it makes us richer people to have the contact.
Well, one thing that is clear, I mean, from those texts is that you can expect to encounter God there. It's not always clear where you're going to encounter God, but in the text, it's pretty clear that
I was thinking of an interesting text that doesn't work completely, but you know, Jesus is surrounded by these crowds of people that are, you know, that are there, and it's getting late, and the disciples say, "I think we need to send these people home." you know? And and what does Jesus say? He says, you feed them. You know, and so they bring the loaves to Jesus, right? And I mean, that's kind of a response to that question of unlimited hospitality.
Mm-hmm. Right.
One possible response.
Yes, that's right.
I think it's really hard to stay encouraged. It seems like it's such an impossible task to even try to get people to think about being hospitable to a group or a people. Mm-hmm. And their comfort zone is so emphasized in this country, and we guard that so drastically, and we don't want to give that up. Mm-hmm. And the selfishness is built into our economy and everything else, and it just makes me, you know, wonder how do we ever get to a point where we can be effective?
Mm-hmm. And so much of Charlie's Bible studies that were sort of addressing that sort of dilemma of where we are in the world right now. Can the churches really provide an alternative voice and perspective? Because most of us are pretty complicit with that, you know, that level of consumerism and comfort and those things. And the churches are right along with that. There were a few hands over here too.
About 18 years ago, our little church sponsored a Vietnamese family. We got a house ready for them and furnished it and everything. We felt quite rewarded. But it was something for a little while, and then they moved on, and we don't hear any more about it. And a change in pastors and leadership.
That kind of dropped by the wayside. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it was very rewarding at the time.
So it was a two-way street, rather than just a one-way street. Mm-hmm.
I think one thing to also keep in mind is that all people that are coming to this country aren't necessarily wanting to just get all the milk and honey here and just take jobs and, you know, really stay here forever. Especially with refugees that I work with, when I ask them, you know, where they want to be in 5 years, or if they won a lottery, what would they do? Always the answer is, I want to go home. You know, I want to go home in 5 years. I don't want to be here anymore. They have to come here. They're forced here by all those push factors. I mean, this terrible war is going on, all these awful things, and so it gives me hope that maybe things will change so that it's safe for them to return to where they really do want to be. And I just think that's an important thing to remember when you're faced with those arguments that, you know, people are coming here for the jobs and for a better, easier life, just remembering that it's not easier here, always.
It's not easier at all.
Well, and the other thing is, we really discovered Mexico, it's not easier there. I mean, what was so astonishing was we went to pueblo after pueblo after pueblo, which are being run by grandmothers. I mean, these grandmothers and small children, because every adult is trying to get someplace where they can raise some money and send it back. And so it has created terrible havoc in these home countries as well, to try and have any sense of normal lifestyle, because so many of them are just trying to get anybody who's able-bodied to go someplace where they can earn some money to raise the children. And so it's really problematic on both sides of the border for what it does to the people involved and their families and their communities. Jim, did you ever? Jim, you have a hopeful word to end us on?
No, but maybe we could end in prayer. Yeah. That's all right.
Yeah, I remind people that tomorrow my last session is going to be on churches respond, how churches can respond, looking at some positive models. So I think there is a lot more hope out there.
What time
is the answer to the prayer that isn't even
3:45.
Yes.
3:45.
Well, let's join in a word of prayer. Gracious God, we know that you come to us as the stranger. We know that our history as your people is one of journey and wandering, of your mighty hand leading us out from Egypt, of our sojourn in the wilderness, and after the defeat of our nations to languish in exile in another country. Help us to realize, God, that all of us who claim the name of you, our Lord, are part of that history of journeying, of struggle, of being lost, of being alone, of being forsaken. Help us, God, to muster the courage and the wisdom to deal with this issue that challenges our country and so many other countries. Help us to be wise as we wrestle with this problem and try to address it at its root causes, but also compassionate, and to treat the people and to not get lost in the numbers. Most of all, God, help us to be your disciples and to be servants of your mercy.